This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen O'Brien. You remember when you used to be able to find starfish all up and down the West Coast, including here in Seattle? Well, since 2013, they seem to have disappeared because of the very kind of outbreak that Drew Harville writes about in her book called Ocean Outbreak. Drew is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Cornell, got her PhD from the UW right here in Seattle. Remind us what killed the starfish, Drew.
Oh, yeah. Good morning, Dave. Nice to be here. Our best evidence suggests it was a virus and spread from the borders with Mexico all the way up into Alaska and affected over 20 different species, at least. We saw first outbreaks north of Howe Sound in Vancouver with the giant sunflower star. And then a couple of months later, in October 2013, there were simultaneous outbreaks in Vancouver Aquarium, Monterey Bay Aquarium, and the Seattle Aquarium. Their captive collections that have been held for over 20 years died very suddenly and precipitously.
The whole premise of the book is that this is continuing with other species of sea life, and there is a real threat out there. And there are a few things scarier than the idea of the oceans dying off and us not being able to do anything about it. So I guess the other question I need to ask for is human activity in some way responsible for these outbreaks, or don't we know?
Well, we know for some of them where human activity is involved. Some of these tiny monsters in the sea or bacteria and viruses can escape from aquaculture, from human sewage, and many of them can be fueled by warming oceans. Now, in the case of the starfish epidemic, this was mysterious because it was a whole new microorganism and a very sudden and unexpected outbreak. Some of the others, for example, the abalone outbreak that I talk about in the book, took almost 15 years to figure out what the causative bacterium was that was killing those and essentially landed them on the endangered species list. And probably some of your listeners know that recently the pinto abalone has been added to the endangered species list.
Now, a lot of people are unfamiliar with these creatures. Why are they important?
Well, to me, I'm an invertebrate biologist. I love these spineless critters, so they're all important to me. But as an ecologist, they also affect the balance of our marine ecosystems. So, for example, the absence of the sunflower star has caused large outbreaks of sea urchins, which have decimated kelp beds, particularly in central California. They're feeling a big impact of this. And, of course, there's also impacts closer to home because we eat some of these things.
Well, salmon. So, you have a chapter about salmon.
Indeed.
And the threat because of the diseases that race through some of these salmon farms, these pens.
The big outbreak I talk about in Ocean Outbreak is, of course, the worldwide, what we call pandemic, that affected farmed Atlantic salmon that was caused by a virus and decimated a lot of these farmed salmon and caused huge economic costs. We are going to have a lot more marine aquaculture, and we need it, but pathogens can increase in some of those highly overcrowded aquaculture conditions. But then our wild Pacific salmon have their own diseases.
They're magnificent creatures, aren't they?
Oh, they're just, I mean, everybody here that's listening loves salmon. There's no question. And they're so fascinating in terms of their life history, the struggles they go through to make it back to their swimming grounds upriver, and then the huge migration back to the ocean. I mean, it's a phenomenal critter.
There must be something you can do about this. I mean, there's no point in studying it if we're just going to wring our hands and do nothing. So what do you think has to happen?
Well, yeah. And really, that's the reason to write this book. One of the fixes I talk about, of course, is best practices for aquaculture to keep that safe for our marine habitats. In our waters, we have some really valuable natural pathogen-fighting habitats. For example, the eelgrasses can very significantly reduce levels of natural bacteria in the water. And we do know that occasionally there are big water quality problems in the Seattle area, sewage spills in the winter with rain. So I think the ecosystem services of habitats like eelgrasses and our wetlands are absolutely vital and kind of underappreciated. One of our goals in creating a healthier ocean is to better understand the natural ecosystem services of these habitats and work harder to preserve them. We're studying a fungal-like slime mold.
Sounds appetizing.
That's seriously impacting our eelgrass from San Diego all the way to Alaska. And we're finding in the waters of the San Juan Islands, that under warming conditions, we're having localized outbreaks that are impacting our eelgrass beds. So that's one we worry about because, of course, it has knock-on effects in terms of being habitat for baby salmon, which are food for orcas. We have a proposal in as part of a salmon recovery funding to restore some eelgrasses in the San Juans where we've lost many of our beds.
Is plastic a factor?
Actually, we've done some work in my lab group on plastic. And what we found in surveys that we did in Indonesia, Myanmar, Thailand, and Australia was that coral animals were 80% more likely to have an infectious disease if they were in contact with plastic, bags and nettings and things.
Can't you train bacteria to eat plastic? Didn't they train bacteria to eat oil?
Yeah, good question. I mean, that's an excellent possibility. We could put a little bit more work into understanding natural microbial processes and how we can put those to work.
The thing that worries me is that we seem to be creating sort of, an alternate environment where every aspect of it has to be managed by some agency. Because now, you know, with global warming about to reach the tipping point, they're talking about putting these crystals into the air to block some of the sun so that it cools off the earth. So you got that going on above. Then you've got people having to breed new bacteria below. Is there any way that if you left it alone, it could restore its own balance?
Well, don't we wish we could just treat these root causes? And if we had lower levels of greenhouse gases, then we wouldn't need to be worrying about all these things. So unfortunately, we've altered things in so many ways that we kind of have to manage the damage that we're causing.
Do you put a deadline on when something has to be done before it's too late? Not that I want you to deliberately scare people, but I mean, give us a feeling for what the stakes are.
It's a little bit out of sight and out of mind and very hard to study in the oceans. And so I wouldn't even dare give you any kind of a deadline or projection, except that every time we have another bout of a marine heat wave or warming conditions, we have new large outbreaks. And so I think they're going to continue. And there's a lot we can do to be improving our ability to manage and respond to these.
So the warming seems to be the key factor.
The scary thing about it is it interacts with all the other stuff we're doing, such as land-based pollution, shipping, aquaculture that also is increasing threats. And so the warming will often, you know, trigger a big outbreak that's been just simmering away.
Drew Harville is the author of Ocean Outbreak, Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Cornell University. Drew, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on, Dave.